Hey, Bob, this is Sean. I'm reading through that article about by Mordecai Richler, all the conspirators. I think maybe Brussels should have sued him for breach of contract, because the contract she made him sign says explicitly, quote, that I will not follow these remarks with snide suggestions, derogatory statements, or generalities and false conclusions, which is exactly what he did. Okay, see you later.
One thing I found really interesting, I'm sorry I couldn't call before your show, but your reference weeks and weeks ago to how the Bush administration were manipulating diplomatic advice that you gave them to its exact opposite effect. And Wednesday's news report seems to hinge on that rejection of a letter to Saddam Hussein. You dealt a lot with the war in your predictions. Care to make any comments about the predictions for famine in Africa? I remember this was a particular concern during the Exist reading on the conspiracy, the suffering that Africa might have to go through. See you. Talk to you.
Hi, Bob. Here's something old that could help us explain why spirit and matter are one. This is from the not-so-secret doctrine of Blavatsky. The tetrad is esteemed in the Kabbalah, as it was by Pythagoras, the most perfect or rather sacred number, because it emanated from the one, the first manifested unit, or rather, the three in one. Thus, number four forms the arithmetical mean between the monad and the heptad, as this contains all powers both of the productive and produced numbers, for this of all numbers under ten is made of a certain number. The duad doubled makes a tetrad, the tetrad doubled or unfolded makes the heptomad, the septenary. The two multiplied into itself produces four, and retorted into itself makes the first cube. This first cube is a fertile number, the ground of multitude and variety, consisted of two and four, depending on the monad, the seventh. Thus, the two principles of temporal things, the pyramid and cube, form and matter, flow from one fountain. The tetragon on earth, the monad in heaven. Rather perceptive for the supposedly hashish addicted devil angel worshipping Blavatsky, huh? Bye.
January 10th, 1991. John, the interview with Bob was great. Bob is great. You are wrong. Mend your broken, borrowed ways. You've been duped. Your ideas are not your own. You are not in control. You are controlled. McLuhan was right. LaRouche is one of the greatest minds of this century. Visual poetry is a military operation. It's time to graduate from the global classroom and begin postgraduate studies. The idea of the trap is a trap. McLuhan invented your double duty in Tarobang. May Brussels was not a frustrated housewife. You're a solipsist just like Zappa. Wake up, baby. You're right. Bob is in the them category. So am I. The us category is full. Sincerely, White Guelph.
And now the greatest rock and roll song ever written.
Thank you.
the electric baby condition.
Hamburgers are $22 in Baghdad.
Hi, Bob. It's Scott. What I'd really like to know is if you've ever probed the exists on the hidden ground behind the Tennessee Valley Authority. I mean, they must be up to something. But aside from that, it's Sunday, January 13th, and you've always tolerated my pedestrian comments on your show. Well, the popular angst being what it is, I was in my favorite watering hole, and they were watching the TV news tonight, and it occurred to me that if you were going to read the papers or watch the TV, that you really, really needed Lyndon LaRouche's organization's information to provide you with an antidote to what's going down, or what's fed you the software, I guess. Of course, if you are convinced that you personally hate LaRouche, and you're willing to engage in media ecology, then you could dispose with both of them. But any imbalance, and to quote Robert Anton Wilson, you're laid, relayed, parlayed, fucked, flustered, and far from home. I'm going to firewalk soon, so I just want to take this opportunity to bid personal greetings to Ed and Sean and gee, who all else, Dublin especially, and yourself, Michael Dyer, who never understood me, Connie, and all that heck. I really appreciate your comments from last show that no fixed point of view is adequate and that we can use this breakdown as a breakthrough. Salut. Tom, of course, I didn't mean to exclude Tom, what seems to be your foremost field operative. Or your foremost visible field operative. Much obliged.
This is the story of Greyface. In the year 1166 BC, a malcontented hunchbrain by the name of Greyface got it into his head that the universe was a humorless disease. And he began to teach that play was sinful because it contradicted the ways of serious order. Look at all the order about you, he said. And from that, he deluded honest men to believe that reality was a straitjacket affair and not the happy romance as men had known it. It's not presently understood why men were so gullible at that particular time. For absolutely no one thought to observe all the disorder around them, including just the opposite. But anyway, Greyface and his followers took the game of playing at life more seriously than they took life itself. They were known even to destroy other living beings whose ways of life differed from their own. The unfortunate result of this is that mankind has since been suffering from a psychological and spiritual imbalance. Imbalance causes frustration, and frustration causes fear, and fear makes a bad trip. Man has been on a bad trip for a long time now. It's called the curse of grace. The following will explain how to revoke the curse of grace. The human race will begin solving its problems from the day that it sees it taking itself so seriously. To that end, it is proposed a counter game of nonsense as salvation. Salvation from an ugly and barbarous existence that is the result of taking orders so seriously and so seriously fearing contrary orders and disorder that games are taken as more important than life, rather than taking life as the art of playing games. To this end, it is proposed that man develop an innate love for disorder and play, and know that it is a joy for play, and that thereby can be revoked the curse of grace. If you can master nonsense as well as you have already learned to master sin, then each will expose the other for what it is, absurdity. From that moment of illumination, a man begins to be free regardless of his surroundings. He becomes free to play order games and change them at will. He becomes free to play disorder games just for the hell of it. He becomes free to play neither or both. And as the master of his own game, he plays without fear, and therefore without frustration, and therefore with goodwill in his soul and love in his being. When men become free, then mankind will be free. May you be free of the curse of Greyface. May you have twinkles in your eyes, and may you have the knowledge of a sage and the wisdom of a child. So say it. Principia Discordia.
Spontaneously on Earth. The first of the hundreds of millions of protein molecules. the truth.
Bush stuff about a new world order. Yeah.
application of power to communication industries hastened the consolidation of vernaculars, the rise of nationalism, revolution, and new outbreaks of savagery in the 20th century. That was Harold Innes, quoted by Marshall McLuhan. Just the outbreak of savagery. I just had to say something, Bob. You know, we're in Toronto, but there's blood being spilled over in the Gulf. So, anyway, we'll listen to you next Wednesday night. Hear what you have to say about this. Good night.
Hi, Bob. It's Martin. I was talking with David.
Okay, Dave. What do you want to say to Bob? Go.
Bob, it's better than Bob ago out here. The Wild West Dogstown, telekinetic and Byron. So I jump on the number 22 bus and head down to the Shiatsu where, whoa, I see Connie's book for sale. So what's happening in the Middle East with the Trilateral Commission, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, and the Illuminati Bolsheviks stirring up the stuff in Iraq? What's the hidden ground, Bob? I'm missing the hidden ground. What's the hidden ground, Bob?
I see David wants to get through to you, Bob, but he's stuck in my telephone. Hold on. What was that?
I have to connect, Bob.
There's no body here.
What?
Dave doesn't have a body.
I'm caught in the void. I'm in the gap between Vancouver and the discarded nub.
Are you conscious, David?
Semi.
This is on tape, Bob.
Bob, this is the electrified voice of Tom Rich. It's 9 o'clock in Toronto on January the 17th, and I'm parked right out in front of number 10 Toronto Street. The gates are open, the lights are burning, I don't know what's happening, but there is a police car right in front, and the number is 6087. 6087 is the police car, right out front of number 10 Toronto Street. There you go. And there's a plainclothesman, and he's talking to a plainclothes cop in a Fury, a Plymouth Fury. So that should tell you something, Bob. Goodbye.
Twenty-three women, children, and elderly reported dead. In Iraq, 23.
Barbara, this seems like such a play war. I mean, it's like toys they're throwing at each other. I mean, first they thought there was chemical warfare, now there's no chemical warfare. It's unbelievable. Nobody really is getting hurt. Mind you, I guess the Iraqi stuff we're not hearing about, but it just seems like it's all being staged. Is this possible? Last night on a television, one of the reports was that a reporter had gone out in Tel Aviv and broken into sweats, and that was the first sign of chemical warfare. And now there's no chemical warfare. I don't understand. Or maybe I do. Bye.
This is Tim calling for Bob. It looks like the 3-week preemption of our favorite TV show was okay because, as you recall, the last line was spoken by the Major, who appears timely, in a timely fashion, and says everything is not all right. And the last show, or rather the last shot of the show, is all of these lights flashing in the sky, kind of like the 16th of January over Baghdad. And it looks like our friend Mikhail Gorbachev is not who he says he is. Any comments? I'll see you later. Bye.
Hi, Bob. It's Julie. Long time no talk. So, we're involved in Operation Desert Storm. Pretty sophisticated name, if you ask me. Just an observation, though. On the first and second attempts of the bombing, did you notice that both times began around 6:30 p.m.? Oh, and by the way, I never got to congratulate you on the Doctors for Bob sign. Gee, I hope when I grow up, my name will be written in psychedelic purple. See ya.
in Tucson, Arizona on the 10th. I was betting on what day the war would begin. The column said the strikor, the strikee, and the time. The only three options you had were Israel, Iraq, and the United States. And the United States represented all of the forces, allied forces over there. At that time, I wrote an article that said that this war will be staged for television. Now, they did a pretty poor job of staging it. The reporters on Sunday TV are saying, well, Marshall McLuhan predicted it would be this way. This is Walter Bullard from Tucson.
Hey, about last 2 weeks, Globe Social Studies page, I was just talking to Chuck and Kathy about the hula hoop, McLuhan's history of it, how in the 40s it was pushed like a wheel along the ground, and then when the tactility and super participation of the TV environment came in the 50s, people's due orientation to the space around them, you know, they would swing the hula hoop around them like they did. Anyways, Chuck has said, and Jeff, they've read in the Globe Social Studies about that this phenomenon has been happening in many countries where TV technology is introduced, and that in some, what is that, what countries do you say, what part of the world? Some African countries that people would hula hoop themselves to death, just do it over and over. I mean, if that's a metaphor, whew, there you go. The hula hoop craze. Yeah, the hula hoop craze occurs at different places at different times.
Here's a little news item from Maclean's magazine, January 14th, 1991. Page 21. For nearly 20 years, Joseph Stalin often used a double to replace him in public functions because of his fear of assassination, according to the Moscow newspaper, Rabochaya Tribuna. After the murder of Politburo member Sergei Kirov in 1934, it claims Stalin had his intelligence agents comb the country for a suitable lookalike. The man they chose was a Jewish accountant from Ukraine, F.C. Lubitsky. Surgeons, hairdressers, and tailors worked on Lubitsky to improve the resemblance. Then, Stalin had them and Lubitsky's family murdered to prevent the secret from leaking out. Later, Stalin exiled Lubitsky to a prison camp. He died after his release following Stalin's death in 1953.
Hey, I don't know if it's lighting or makeup, but from the perception of my black and white TV, there's definitely like more than one George Bush. And also, here's some content getting lost in the mud. CNN's been reporting, you know, that they fired, you know, a bunch of scuds and some of them hit the ground. They even had like a film of it happening. And the Pentagon is saying they didn't, and so some of the stations other than CNN are just going with the Pentagon story as being like the news. So, There you have it. Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention, one of the things that I saw today, they had a Marine sergeant, lecturing his troops, and he was saying, he goes, now, you're not here, you're here for love, and we're not talking about love of your country or love of America or apple pie or anything like that. You're here for your buddies. For your buddies. That's what it's all about. So there you have, clearly, they know you have to have human scale in order to totally properly motivate people. So I think that was what he was trying to say. But if he wasn't, leave a message. If he was, then don't say anything, because I already did. Right, Bob? Stupid stuff, eh? That's okay, though.
World record.
What was it, 25 to 1 half-hour messages?
Over 30 minutes.
Yeah, great. Right.
As I've said this before, I think inevitably this show will just become 2 hours of messages. And
yeah, the church members.
You won't have to come in. You can just leave your tape in the folder.
Well, it was 33 messages. I added them up as we went, and that's Masonic. That's appropriate. And it's just by coincidence, Dave was the last message talking about the human scale, love your buddy. That was the opening theme song, our new theme song for at least tonight. I don't know if it'll happen again. But that song celebrated all those who are falling in love during this period of tension.
Did you want to comment on that theme song and why it wasn't the normal theme song?
I just did. It was about... you know, I found the kiss, I found the love, right? It's a human scale. And it also is very important for those people who are finding that experience right now, even though the rest of the world is shivering in their boots, right? So I thought it was appropriate that we end off with Dave's message talking about these Marines got to love their buddies. That's what they're fighting for. That's nostalgia for human scale, eh? But before we get into explaining the war, we got to make a couple messages. First off, this is Kent Perry's second last show tonight. He'll be back, I understand, in 2 weeks to do his last show. Now, tonight we got a special. We got to send Kent out with the rave reviews. So we're playing an ancient conference call that we did on International Connection, or Bob Marshall and Tom Rich and Adam Bond did, with Mae Russell and Sherman Skolnick. I think it's about an hour. It's really good. It was first broadcast September 25th or so, September 27th, 1985. And this may be our last chance to hear May and Skolnick with Kent leaving. So we sent it up with a whole hour of us talking, you know, perkily with May and Skolnick about why we're in our present condition. And then in 2 weeks, Kent's last show, we will feature the astounding Exus reading that I did, my private reading on death and what happens when you die. This may be appropriate for a lot of us to understand this. We may be meeting our maker any point now. So in 2 weeks, we can look to a wonderful send-out by Kent playing the Exus for over an hour. A little side effect of that topic is the difference between mescaline and LSD. So we're still worried about that. The Exus will clarify that. But the main point is this awesome explanation of what happens when you die, Mike.
It's been a meteoric rise for Kent Perry, hasn't it, from his formative years here at CKLN?
Do you remember when he came down in 88? Do you remember why he came down?
It was because of me, wasn't it?
May
was one reason why I can't start listening to the station.
That might have been it, but for me, the personal reason was he came down on Canada Day in July 88, and he wanted to read his poem, and we featured him as Canadian content. And he read his poem, and we were just swept away with it, and then... Over the next couple of weeks, you got to know Kent's background in the music industry and realized he'd stolen hundreds of albums, had an incredible collection while working in the industry. And so Mike said, hey, come on in and take over the Wednesday slot.
That's right, because the story was that Kent was managing a restaurant, which, of course, has since folded as a result of Kent leaving.
Yeah, the Pizza Connection.
An entire franchise just went under. And Kent used to pump CKLN into the restaurant.
Yeah,
while families were eating their meals late at night, and
revolutionary should be in Grail Marcus's Lipstick Traces, Secret History of the 20th Century. They should mention Kent's work.
And then for a long time, from 2 to 7, there was no one on the air after me, and that seemed like a waste, so it went from there.
Kent auditioned, he got the job even before he put his demo in. That's how much we needed people back then, right?
We were desperate.
And then, of course, Kent, what? Kent, you want to say something? Oh, okay, good. Yeah, he's just talking to Mike. But so Kent then got converted to Bob's work, and they started featuring some old Club 22 greatest hits, and we appreciate that. And then tonight and in 2 weeks are going to be awesome cappers of that. What? What, Kent? You ain't talking to me, right?
Converted to Bob-isms.
That's right, Bob-isms. Not me, the process.
Yes.
I mean, I guess I don't think there would be any... radio guide in the world that lists Subgenius, Discordian, and Zappa as the mandate of a person's program, right?
In one breath.
Yeah. And, Kent, you never heard, I think you were gone, that the little wording you have with your notes, program notes, is something about sound creates image and image creates question mark. Is that the way it goes? You know, I had a feeling I was just looking through Naked Lunch or something, and I found that line in Naked Lunch. Or is that where you got it from, or accident?
Variation. I thought I had mainly thought of it myself, but Naked Lunch was...
Probably in your mind.
was a big influence in my earlier years as a writer.
Yeah, because a variation very close to what you wrote in the program notes is in some part of Naked Lunch. I just haven't noticed it. And, of course, you know Bill Burroughs yourself. You visited him and had some intimacies with him, right?
Burroughs is a big influence on my writing.
Yeah.
Not that much anymore, but...
Well, you don't write anymore, right?
Oh, no, I still write.
Oh, okay.
I'm doing nonfiction right now, though, as opposed to fiction.
Okay, well, what else can we say about Kennedy? Oh, yeah, the amazing thing about Kennedy is he wowed the executive by raising so much money during fundraising. He topped the equal people during the day, which was never done before, the amount of money he raised.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A lot of it was donated by me, but we had to make Kent look good. We had lots of people.
Wasn't
that? Oh, wasn't it? Oh, that was the other guy. Okay.
That one.
Just as well.
All right. Yeah, so... is that enough about Kent?
That's enough. Yeah, Kent will talk about himself.
Yeah, maybe in 2 weeks we'll interview Kent late in the morning after the Exodus reading. You know, talk to him, get him to review.
Throw it back at him.
Speak to himself. Sure. You know, get him to speak for himself. That's callers, I bet.
We do, but a few other opening comments. Did you also have one other message? A couple of pieces of business.
Well, the 2 points were the Exodus reading in 2 weeks on death and the May Brussels tonight. And, of course, we have a new phrase. I don't know where I got it from, but I got the notes here. We're witnessing motivated somnobilization. Motivated somnobilization. That could be a theme tonight.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Instead of motivated somnambulist, it becomes motivated somnobilization.
Any other comments on the Gulf crisis?
It'll probably come out in the calls. So here is a statement. The media archetypes are in a state of cool panic versus the human scale. That's why we're not seeing any people in the war. It's the battle. Yes, Mike.
Well, no, my only comment is the hype about this war being, I think one of your, was it Julie who commented on this was just that it was like a game.
Oh, that was it, yeah.
Yeah, and the sports analogy keeps coming up. They sound like the same sort of people talking who are interviewed after a hockey game or you know, pre-football.
That's right. Same kind of level of speculation.
Yeah, yeah. We're just going out there to do our best.
Yeah,
and
our goal,
our hardest.
Our goal is to win.
Yeah.
What are your goals? Well, we hope to score more goals than the other guy.
But the other thing is, I mean, with obviously this, again, this might come up tonight, is just the talking about the crisis from the point of view of it being a media circus, and suddenly this new technology, you know, since Vietnam, which will allow us to, you know, be on the front lines to view the war as it unfolds, of course, is an absolute fallacy, because everyone is censoring the news. There's no one in Baghdad. And the irony is this one guy in Baghdad from CNN, I forget the reporter's name, is there. And
Peter Arnett.
Yeah. And they cut to a picture of Peter sitting next to a satellite dish. It reminds me of the RCA dog, you know, kind of dog and its master. And there's Peter sitting on a chair on the phone next to a satellite dish, you know, not getting any news out other than through the phone, and it's just not working.
Hi. Oh, someone come in?
It's just Marfa.
Oh, okay. So what we're getting here is the media archetypes are battling between themselves, but because they are panicking due to the mood of human scale retrieved over the past, say, 18 months since my work has really blossomed, the need for human scale has become a very aberrant need over the last year, and of course this panics the media archetypes, so they are programming a battle against human scale. It's really against human scale. They're reacting to the mood. But what happens is they are fighting between themselves. And this creates a condition of cool panic where we use the media, or the media is being used for itself, but there's nothing provided. So you have the reporter reporting as a satellite agent, but there's no content provided by the hardware battle going on. So the media archetypes are not communicating with each other in a state of cool panic. That's what's happening. All in a reaction to human scale. Now, the hidden ground to human scale is that media archetypes are us. We must remember that media are extensions of us. It's just that the media archetypes are reacting to the mood of human scale. And because they do not want to make that obvious, they have to pretend that there's a human scale involved. Therefore, anybody who gets pinched, tickled, or scraped gets huge coverage. And the relatives, right?
Right.
Immense
right.
coverage. But we're all in a position of watching a game. What appears to be a game, the game is, it's the battle, the theatrical battle between the archetypes. We're all in the stadium. We're in a human scale position.
Well, I understand why they're doing this, but also the Canadians, the CBC, CTV, and so on, they're always the main news items of the day, how many scouts have been fired for the day, and so on. And then there's always mention of the Canadian CF-14s.
And 14, eh? There's that number, 14. That's coming up. Yeah.
Well, what has or has, it always becomes topical. Have they flown today? Will they be in action? Because a lot of people, you know, you hear a lot of hardliners saying things like, I'm ashamed to be a Canadian because our Canadian boys aren't there fighting.
But Canadians always choke, and they've got the weather as an excuse this time.
Every day.
They're blessed. They love that weather because they don't have to perform because they're going to choke when they have to, mm-hmm. right? Canadians always choke. That's our national characteristic. We prefer human scale, which makes us sort of uncomfortable dealing with the giant media archetypes.
And the other thing, again, that... I don't know, this Canadianism that comes out is the vision of the members of Parliament standing almost a week after the war started to say, we agree with this war, we as Canadians will participate in this war 7 days into the fighting or 6 days into the fighting. It just seems
It's like a game. See, in McLuhan's book, Understanding Media, The Extensions of Man, the only other chapter that has the phrase extensions of man is the chapter titled Games. In other words, the title has Understanding Media, : The Extensions of Man. Then he has Games, : The Extensions of Man. So media and games are cultural responses to the formal causality of the interplay of the archetypes. So this game, since we're now post-media archetypes in a super-angelic, human-scale, retrieved state in the solar theater, then, of course, it appears to be a game. Because that's what media have been reduced to.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are not the real reality. The real reality is the coverage. There are more people covering the war, more people talking about it than are taking part in it. Unless you're an Iraqi citizen in Baghdad. And we're not allowed to hear about that. Because...
Not yet.
Unless they are pretty protected in their fallout shelters. Anyways, the big one should happen pretty soon, right? When the ground troops go, then we get back, and that's when software has to fight hardware, and we'll get them into exciting climactic movement and tempo at that point. So I'm looking forward to the ground mm-hmm. fight. We're going to have it. Israel has to figure out its relationship to that inevitable battle. What point does it come in?
Yeah, unless it's reserving its right.
And if you listen to May Bressel, you'll know that this nuclear war scenario, even though it's quite constricted and controlled right now, it has been on the agenda for 30, 40 years, and that Pentagon gang is going to have it no matter what. So they're going to have it, but they're not going to be able to pull it off as widespread as they hope. Now remember, General Schwarzkopf, which means blackhead, the head guy, the commander of the whole war. I have never seen anybody who looks like a Pentagon Bolshevik than that guy. He reminds me of Finnegan's Wake. The main character in Finnegan's Wake is HCE, Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker. And he's hard of hearing due to the effect of the prank queen. He has a visual bias, so he can't hear. His acoustic sensibility is suppressed a little. Well, when Schwarzkopf first started his interview with the press, he'd lean into the mic, or he'd lean and look at an angle, and he couldn't hear the questions, because he's such a visually biased guy, the American version of kinetic bias. He's a manipulative kinetic bias kind of person, but within the visual hardware background, he is just not used to acoustic space.
The only other thing I want to mention about the war, and then we'll go on about three calls already, is the... I think the best name for a correspondent, you know the person I'm talking about.
Yeah, Wolf Blitzer.
Wolf Blitzer, the Pentagon correspondent.
Now, he comes up from the Jerusalem Post. I don't know how long he was at the Jerusalem Post, but maybe he was scouted and planted in the Jerusalem Post and then brought over to the Pentagon because of his name. What's your source of magic? Your face or your fortune? Or your face or your name? Well, this guy's name is it. And what is the wolf? The wolf is a zombie wolf, the Zappa... saying about the zombie wolf in your mind's eye that we all see if you're evolved enough, right? And Blitzer, we know what that is. So we've retrieved the 40s again. We retrieved the 40s with the Republican administrations.
Okay, let's go to the calls. We've got a few people waiting. You're listening to the Church of the Subgenius show, and it's 12:45. You keep your questions, maybe one question, and if you've got really good interaction happening with Bob, then we'll keep things going. Let's see if this will work. Hello. Are you there? You're not there anymore. Hello?
Oh, what's that?
Wake up. Wake up, it's Touche.
Again, it's Touche.
I'm glad you recapitulated, Bob. That you decided to follow my immediate orders.
Which was to go to war? Was it to go to war?
I'm in control of Iraq and the UN now, Bob.
And what do you intend to do with me?
I know you can't publicly admit it, but your fall from grace was like lightning.
And when did that happen?
Even though you've lost all seniority on the Council of Death, now that I'm in charge of all the Minutemen, I'll protect you at least for the next while, as long as you play ball with me, Bob. What? I'll leave you alive.
What do I have to do?
It's too bad for you that when the music stopped, I was the last one to grab for the mat. While you chose wrong, you grabbed the chair, forgetting that we're living in a post-chair age.
Well, I think the last time you showed up in this show was January 9th. And, of course, you declared war on me, and war did break out. So we know that you are a key catalyst of this conflict in the Secret Council of Ten.
I know it's Kidney who is your real lover.
James Kidney. He played Lee Harvey Oswald because he... because he looked like him. Well, let me just tell you this, Touche. The bill's in the mail because your son did not arrive at the Doctors for Bob Institute today. And Connie is mad when you miss an appointment. You're in big trouble. The bill is huge for a missed appointment. All right, so you quiver in your boots and send your lackey, you know who, to substitute, and not Bob Neffert.
Any other calls, Mike?
Yeah, there's a couple of calls.
Okay.
Hello?
Hello, am I on?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, okay, great. Boy, that's going to be a tough one to follow.
That's a real fight. Don't worry about it. It's kind of like a hijacking of the good feeling we're supposed to generate on the radio show here. But Tom's going to be interacting quite frequently in the future because, or not Tom, Tom Touche, whatever his name. I get him mixed up with Tom Rich. But he's going to be interacting because he's the real reason why there's a battle going on behind the scenes. He was my butler, and I'm in trouble. He's betrayed me.
You can handle it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, going back, you mentioned a lot of the things that I was going to mention. Anyways, there's one other name situation outside of the Blackhead and Blitzer deal, and that is the chap who they often interview representing the Israelis. His name is Netanyahu.
Yeah, he claims he's not a Yahoo. Yeah. I noticed that.
That was pretty cute. But there's one thing, watching Nightline yesterday, they interviewed some guys at the front who were practicing with their tanks, you know, to sort of, as a preliminary to the ground fight, which is going to be the most interesting thing.
Yeah, are they the farm system?
Yeah.
They're down there in the bullpen.
Yeah, that's right. So in any case, they showed some of these people giving a war chant, and they were, you know, it was kind of like in 2001, all of the kind of apes and stuff like that around the pool, and one guy had a bone and things like that. But anyways, they're going away and chanting, and the interviewer says, "Well, I couldn't understand a word you were saying. Could you slow it down for me?" And they did, and this is a quote. I quote, "This is what the frontline troops are chanting. No slack, no slack, courage conquers, no damn slack."
Are you kidding?
No, this is true. This is absolutely true. And I just about flipped at that point.
Could you say that again? I can't believe it.
Yeah, they were singing it. No slack, no slack, courage conquers, no damn slack. I mean, they had them interpret it, and I presume that they meant we're not going to give the Iraqis any slack, but we know what it really means. I mean, nobody's getting any from this deal.
It's like one of our callers said, this is very badly performed presentation.
Theater.
Yeah, very bad theater. People are bored already, but one of the most touching scenes for me was they showed some guy, young kid, polishing his Scud missile or something, and he was saying to his buddy, "Oh, I can't wait till we find Hussein. We'll find him kneeling kneeling in the corner on his knees, begging, "No, don't kill me, don't kill me." Now, can you believe the fantasy?
What kind of comic books are they sending?
Yeah, yeah. What kind of fantasy are these discarnate kids living in to think they're going to find Hussein? I mean, we don't even know who we're sending these missiles into Tel Aviv or to Saudi. We don't know who's doing it.
No.
I mean, Hussein will probably show up in Australia.
That's quite possible. Could show up anywhere. He could show up nowhere. This guy is really discarnate.
Yeah, he really doesn't exist in any knowable human terms.
No.
But I love the way he looks. I mean, when he walks around, he has a nice smile. I mean, it's a little mean, but he looks like, what's that guy, Omar Sharif?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he looks so happy, you know. His time has come. He's hogged the media archetypes, and everybody is looking at him.
Exactly. That's what he's always wanted to be in any case.
Yeah.
What I'm kind of wondering is...
He's going to say he's bigger than the Beatles. And the world will be outraged. You won't have to refer to Jesus Christ, right?
Not quite. I wanted to refer to the heads of the network at this point because you've got to wonder who pulled the plug on the 24-hour coverage. Was it just because there weren't any humans saying anything of substance because of the censorship, or did the ratings go down after the first 48 hours of nonstop coverage? I mean, were people really completely bored with it at one point? And somebody said, okay, we're going. At one point, someone had to say, we're going to cut the 24-hour coverage, and we're just going to go to these hourly report things.
Yeah,
somebody had to make that decision on some basis.
Well, I saw a report on Monday or Sunday on CNN where they interviewed a couple of shopkeepers and cinema owners, and they complained that Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, nobody went to the shops, nobody went to the movies, everybody watched. But by Sunday night, Monday or so, everybody was out walking around being normal again.
That's right. It's time for a new show.
Yeah, and the Pentagon is getting worried. I noticed Colin Powell today saying under my orders, he was saying, look, I want to explain this to you. We're having moods of euphoria and then moods of depression. Now, let me try to work this tanglement out. I didn't stay to hear what his explanation is, but he's like a director, you know. He's like Coppola getting mad in the middle of The Godfather, like, you know, nobody's performing properly.
Yeah, more like Cecil B. DeMille, really.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and he's panicking because he's not sure what's happening, but something is starting to slip away. That wasn't you laughing. I'm sorry.
No, I don't know where that one came from.
That was insane. Yeah, go on. So,
I don't know what to go on about.
Okay,
frankly,
how about
except
this?
That it's been wonderful being completely plugged in. I mean, talk about being discarnate. The fact of the matter is, you know, for 48 hours, there are an awful lot of people whose right hands were on the flicker, and that was their lives.
You're right.
You know, I mean, you get to a story you don't want to hear about, somebody, you know, somebody in Arkansas watching TV, click, next. You know, somebody's brother somewhere on a ship somewhere, click, next. You know, you're waiting for somebody to do something real, like lie down under a bed in some hotel and then have glass shatter at him or something.
Well,
like
just
that.
Think, everybody in the world was in that CNN hotel that first night where the guy left the microphone on the windowsill so we could hear it.
Yeah.
We were all in the hotel, and the hotel was in everybody's home. Where were we? Everybody. In other words, we were bombing ourselves and broadcasting the bombing of ourselves.
Exactly. That was exciting.
That was exciting. And you notice the time was 6:32.
Oh, yeah. They, you know, talk about lack of coincidence. I mean, these people knew exactly when the bombs would be hitting. It was right in the middle of the news. I mean, there's no point in doing it beforehand because people weren't home for work, and afterhand, people would be pissed off because they'd be breaking into Wheel of Fortune.
That's right. Now, here's the key. For the Iraqis, it was 2:32 a.m., January 17th. Now, the numbers we use in the show here are 18 and 22, so January 17th is 1 and 17 is 18. But 2:30... Okay.
Sorry.
The call. It's like we're being nuked. Lasered. Caller, I was just saying to you, you might want to respond.
You want me to come up with?
Too bad.
Okay, yes.
Okay. Are you okay, Mike?
Yeah,
everything's going. The point is it was 2:32 Iraqi time. Now, there's the 22 and the 3 in the middle, but you just take the 3 and you put it in front of the first 2 and you get 3:22. Now, scholars of the top-down analysis know that 3:22 is the number, the magical number for the Skull and Bone Society, the secret society out of Yale that George Bush is well known to have been part of. And the reason they have the number 3:22 is two reasons. It's the death of Aristotle and, I think, the birth of Democritus. But for some reason, these secret people maybe because they hate the Platonists, use the number 322 B.C. is important. So at 232, two nights in a row, they have the bombings. I think we can look at it that way. The 632, that's 9, and 2 is 11. That's half of 22. Not too good. The other point is that in World War One, the battle, the paranoia caused by movies and the beginning of telegraph movies and the beginning of radio was the Germans were looking for a place in the sun. Where they were still operating under center margin structures, they wanted a place in the sun. And then World War II was more claustrophobic as the radio environment began to dominate, and so the Germans were worried about Lebensraum, which was kind of a feeling claustrophobic. That was their complaint, so they started World War II apparently over that bottom-up reason. Now, World War III has been the post-industrial information barrage overkill, and we're now witnessing World War IV, and the key word that started that war was linkage. Now, what's interesting is to the acoustic Iraqis, linkage means everybody's interdependent, and under electric conditions, that's a fact. So, therefore, they want to link the Palestinian problem to their problem. But visually biased, kinetic biased American says linkage does not matter. There is no linkage in this problem between Bush and Hussein, supposedly. So you have two cultural responses to the fact that we are interlinked electrically. The American does not see the linkage as a resonating interval, interpenetrating. They see it as a series of connections, visual mechanical connections, and they don't see a connection between Israel and the West Bank and the PLO and Palestinians and Kuwait. So linkage is the key word for World War IV, which really is the flip point of World War III, which was the knocking down of the walls. The Battle of Jericho was fought by the media archetypes. But then what happens here in World War IV, we've flipped into a specialized aspect of hijacking the media archetypes for panic cool, or cool panic maybe is a better way to say it. And that's World War IV, the flip of World War III. Okay, Mike, I rest my case.
I don't see you,
Dobbs. You heard me. I knocked that last guy off the air. Show you the power. Bob, I can admit to you now that your former influence on the council has been totally eliminated.
How can you prove that? You can't prove it to anybody, and you don't have access to the executive at CKLN, so I remain in the electric chair here. You can never dominate. You can only do guerrilla raids like now.
There's a double agent in your family midst.
I don't have a family.
Iraq and the UN.
What?
I now have the power to control Iraq and the UN now that you're out of the way, and I'm rewriting the new tribal encyclopedia without you, Dobbs. Without your silly input, Owlspeak will soon swallow the known universe. I'm the one who swallowed Furry Lit. Go back to Nova Scotia and become a fisherman, Bob. You failed in your prime goal. Go back and be a fisher of men when you failed at. Last word.
Cut him off, Mike. Cut him off.
The recording.
Did you cut him off, Mike?
He actually hung up on his
own. No, I think you cut him off. Great work, Mike. That shows the power we have. Okay, we're going to have to put up with that. I guess you're going to have to screen the calls better, Mike. You got this two-shade guy's getting in too much. Any other callers?
No, not for the moment.
Uh-oh, we got to perform, Mike. All right, just looking over the notes here. Touche will find this interesting because it's what he's trying to hijack. I think we've come to the point of explaining what news is. And what is the word made up of N-E-W-S referring to? Well, the sub-theme is the phrase, the word makes the market. Therefore, you could say the news makes the market. This was obvious in the 20s when the news upset the stock market and created the crash. But we're in a new situation where news does not affect just the market. And also the idea of what news is expanded. For example, when the owners gave up in the late 20s and the managers took over in the 30s, and then advertising took over in the 40s, and then after that, PR took over and advertising became an art form. But following that pattern, you see that you approach news with two kinds of perspectives. One is efficient causality, the connections and mechanical causes in things, the sequential effects. And then there's formal causality, which is the interplay of the audience and the form, the user and the form. So for news as formal causality, that would be media ecology. And you'd understand the phrase news that stays news in relation to media ecology. Then for efficient causality, you have two kinds of subsidiary news. You have what's called journalism, and then you have the other news, which is advertising. Now, it takes a lot of bad news or journalism to sell the good news being the advertising in any medium. Most people can't take good news because it upsets what they already have and says they're missing something new, which would be better. So good news, paradoxically, has a bad effect. So you need a lot of bad news or the emotion of surviving, the survivor emotion. And that's what we get all the time in the news, to bounce off the bad effect of good news. So bad news serves an efficient purpose here. Now, you have efficient causality, bad news and good news, and formal causality, media ecology as news. And therefore, the word that makes the market, when you're using formal causality, you would have occasional media fast if you did it properly, and that would alter the market. But in the efficient causality, the bad news and advertising control the market. In formal causality, the word, the news, the medium that's dominating in its sensory bias shapes the audience and its preference for particular purchasing in the market or trends, forms of sharing. That's formal causality. That's how the word shapes the market. But you have an efficient mechanical sequential connection because the bad news and the good news shapes the market on a content level.
Well, I think we should take some calls.
Okay, great.
Okay, we have the electrified voice of Tom.
Rich. Not Tom Touche.
Coming up, but I do have a caller who's been waiting on hold. He's on a cellular phone, so.
Okay, the cabbie?
Could yes. Be.
Hello.
Yes, it's Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Yeah. Box 1324. I talked to you 2 weeks ago.
That's right. Great call.
Yeah, I've driven a passenger in the meantime, dropped him off at Young and Wealthy. Anyway, moving right along.
Well, when you were on 2 weeks ago, you were talking to us while driving some passengers.
Yeah, I actually pulled over so I could talk to you so there wouldn't be any interference, because when you move from one cellular zone to the other, you get this clicking and it sounds like the phone is being, hanging up.
Did the passengers mind?
Oh, no, they thought it was great. I gave them your number. Actually, I think one of them wanted to call you when she got home. It was a guy and a girl that were both finishing work.
You mean you gave the radio number?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, interesting stuff. I do Bible study almost every day. I go to a congregation every week. I listen to your church, but I'm not a member of your congregation. I'm a member of another congregation.
Is it Herbert W. Armstrong?
No. Oh. Actually, it's Messianic Jewish. Hebrew Christian?
Yeah.
Okay. There's about 3 Messianic Jewish congregations in Toronto, and there's about 140 or so in North America.
I know of them, people who were in that in the 70s. Is that when it started?
Our congregation is called Congregation Melech, M-E-L-E-C-H, Israel with a Y.
Yeah.
And Melech in Hebrew means king, so Congregation King of Israel. And it's on Rainy Avenue now, and it's about 14 years old.
Right, that's in the 70s, yeah.
Yeah, and the minister, or rabbi, whatever, is actually Dutch. His name is Hans Vanderwerf.
Yeah.
And
what's he say? How does he use the Bible in relation to what's happening now?
Well, actually, I have it with me. He's on holiday. But his stand-in, who's actually a school teacher, Mark Neugebauer, and he is assistant pastor, and we went over this instead of a sermon last weekend in service, which is on Saturday, by the way.
Yeah.
he went over quite a number of references, and it's in Old Testament, by the way, Daniel chapter 11. Now, if you read Daniel chapter 10, 11, and 12, you'll get a pretty good idea. But this is referring to this battle, not the battle in the future. And I'm reading 11, verse 12, chapter 11, verse 12 in Daniel. And it says, I'll start at 11, 11. Now, isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
Then the king of the south will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north. Now, in this particular instance, there are other references in the Bible, by the way, to the north and the south. In those instances, it's talking about Russia and other kings in the south, which would be south of Israel.
Yeah.
Okay, but in this reference, it's talking about this particular battle. Then the king of the south will march out in rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands, yet he will not remain triumphant. For the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years, he will advance with a huge army fully equipped. And it goes on and on and on. And in chapter 11, verse 20, he comes to battle again with a much bigger army and so on. But basically, he self-destructs like the Roman Empire. This is
Who self-destructs?
Well, this would be Persia. It's referring to Persia here. Which
the
is,
the guy course, who gets beat in the first battle.
Yes, he comes back again and takes over a lot of countries and so on and so forth and stirring it up.
And then he self-destructs again?
Yeah, it says his successor, well, this is chapter 11, verse 20. His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle.
Now, is that the famous Armageddon? Or?
Well, no, we're talking about this particular battle. But what the Bible basically is saying, now we're about 99% sure that the Bible is referring to this battle, and there's many references. We went through Revelation, Daniel, Jeremiah, both Jeremiah, the whole chapter 50 and the whole chapter 51, Isaiah and Zechariah and a couple others.
Yeah, that's this battle now. That's the first one that he loses.
Yeah, and this is what this fellow on Vision Channel, Jack Van Impe, has been predicting, that this is not the big battle, that the big battle will come probably about 1996, because that's when they expected Iraq to have nuclear power, or enough nuclear power to make weapons. So
according to my sources, the families that Bush and the Anglo-American oil sisters are organizing in Iraq to take over from the Baathist Party, they will become an enemy again.
This little tea to tea could only last a few weeks. And as we can see, it's being drawn out as long as possible by the Iraqis because of their movable scuds and so on. And I let me hazard a guess. I would say that this thing won't go on longer than 3 weeks to 2 months.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And the reason for that is because it won't benefit Saddam Hussein amongst his own people or amongst the Muslims, and obviously they're not responding to his call of a jihad or a holy war. So therefore, he is can only make the people more angry with him if he continues this battle and more people are killed. So he, if he's got any smarts at all, would say, okay, I give.
Okay, what's the position of your church on the Zionist political movement?
Well, the quote that's been raised in the past, Zionism is racism, but basically the Bible's very, very clear and you have to understand that the term Israel used in the Bible can be referring either to the country Israel, to the Jews Israel, or to the believers Israel. Okay, the Christians.
Yeah.
Because obviously, Jesus and his disciples were all Jewish.
Yeah.
And so you have to understand it. You have to take it in context. And not every passage is easily understood. You have to study the Bible for a long time. And, of course, you have to read a few theologians and hear a few sermons. And then you get a much better perspective. But the media themselves and the journalists and so on are saying they do not understand Saddam Hussein. All you have to do is read the Bible to understand him, because he thinks he's King Nebuchadnezzar II.
Yeah.
He wants to rebuild Babylon. Babylon is only 40 miles from Baghdad, and he wants to have control over that whole area of the world. And this is his belief, and this is his perception. So when he's quoting to George Bush about Jesus Christ and God this and God that, he really believes this stuff.
Yeah.
And any of these media types who really want to understand, all they have to do is read up on Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible, and they will start to understand.
Yeah, we have nothing but replays, tribal replays, under the global theater electric conditions. So he's retrieving that Middle East archetype in his cultural context.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. It's I think that we're going to see in the future. We're going to see in the future. The guy's trying to flag me down there. Turn off my roof light. I'm sitting out in front of Maitland and Young here. So,
yeah.
A couple of the.
So you told him you're telling him. You tell him you're discarnate. You're not in the car. You're on the airwaves. Well, you got killed.
It's like losing the CNN satellite, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I guess that person demanded to have his cabin stepped in and knocked the phone out of his hand.
Well, since Mark has been talking about Zionism, since you brought it up, maybe we should just go right to Tom.
Oh, yeah, Tom's always keen. Tom Rich is keen to talk about Zionism.
Hello, Tom.
Hello there, Mike, and hello there, Bob, and this is the electrified voice of Tom Rich.
Yes, yes.
Bob, the new sphere is getting tighter around our necks.
Is it?
It's getting tighter around my neck.
Tell me.
I think that as our technology begins to tackle the light barrier, our mental concepts hobble toward the challenge of the archaic oat barrier.
Oak barrier?
Oat. O-A-T. The oat barrier.
What's that?
Well, that would take volumes to elucidate tonight.
Yeah, but who are you getting that from? What specialty uses that phrase?
Oh, that's mine.
The oat barrier.
The oat barrier.
You mean food?
Food.
Yeah.
Just back to basic survival.
That's the body. As the software absorbs the discarnate, you know, we lose sight of the basic body.
That's right. But
that would
no
be the
excuse.
Flip in the human scale, Tom. Human scale would be the need for food.
That's right. And there's no excuse that people who only have to worry about surviving and getting food, there's no excuse for them, Bob, to not have to spend time sharpening and honing their fireproof perceptual apparatus.
Especially if they have children.
Especially if they have children. But the dialogue between the cultures is becoming as pervasive as back fence gossiping as we're hearing tonight from CNN and all your listeners about the war going on.
Yeah.
And I think that once again, we've just got to bring people's attention to the fact that when you put your eyes and ears and nerves and you out on the satellites and lease these places to stand to private operators as a monopoly, you're going to get what we've been witnessing over the last few weeks, a new reality created for us, which has nothing to do with the truth. The Wizard of Oz is out there, and the goal, and what should be the goal of every listener tonight, should be to decide how, like the little doggy, he can find the man behind the curtain pulling the levers. The theater without walls does have a backstage door, and everybody's got to pull up their socks and take the energy it takes to figure out what's really going on and recognize that on a collective level, since they control our eyes and ears and nerves, they can create whatever world we want and the world they want and make the world turn in whatever tempo they choose. And I think this is an important thing to concentrate on and go over, and I like to repeat it over and over. And certainly the point you made about Confederation, I've been making about Confederation and Zionism being only a generation apart, both belief structures created by wordsmiths at British intelligence, is something which does pop up now in that Netanyahu was on the air talking about how Israel is not at war with Iraq. Well, the entire world was at war with Iraq except for Israel. Now, what does that mean? Were they sitting behind the scenes pulling the levers? Were they the front men for the Wizard? I don't know. I think that it's rather interesting, the fact that everybody's at war with Iraq except Israel. A big flip here.
And Israel's involvement is the moves into the nightmare scenario, the Pentagon Pinks call it, right?
That's right.
So they have to sit on the sidelines.
they have to sit on the sidelines. It's not that they have to. It's just that they think that by sitting on the sidelines, they're going to remain invisible. And I think that they have...
Now, that reminds me of the phrase, the emperor is in the audience.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe you could allude upon that.
Elude. I'll just be elusive on this point. I mean, 10 Toronto Street is right here in Toronto.
Well, I'll tell you, I gave you that report, and you played it tonight, and it was rather electrifying to be down across the road from 10 Toronto Street, because there were police swarming around the place on Victoria Street, the back door, the road that goes on the back of it,
on the
west side, and on the east side. There were a number of police. The lights were burning bright. And, I mean, you really had the feeling that this was invisible headquarters for what was going on. It was like you were at the center of the maelstrom. There was a tremendous amount of calm there.
And this was like 24 hours after the war supposedly started.
Well, it was exactly within minutes of the first night of all the missiles being launched at Israel.
Oh, yeah.
It was the 17th, was it not?
I don't know.
Yes, it was the 17th.
Yeah.
It was 9 at night on January the 17th.
Well, you know, just before I left Dobstown, I caught on the community cable station number 10 a speech by Conrad Black to some people. I don't know where it was, but he looked like Richard Dreyfuss in a very angry atmosphere. I just got a sense of when he was talking through clenched teeth, and the anger coming out of that person.
Tremendous anger, and I think you commented that he was the tribal man wearing a literate man's mask. Was that it?
Well, how did you know I said that? Are you working with Tom Touché? How did you know I said that? You wouldn't know. Okay, let's note this, Mike, what Tom Rich just said. But yes, aside from the surveillance, what did I say? I said something about a tribal man.
Said that Conrad Black appeared to you to be the tribal man wearing the literate man's mask. Is that the tribally opposed to being tribal?
Yes, he was a tribal man trying to put on the podium literate speaker. And as some media analysts say, when people read a lot, they get square-jawed,
mm-hmm.
All right? Especially the pre-literate moves into literacy, becomes square-jawed. Well, he had his teeth clenched like he was square-jawed when he was reading his speech. And he had no normal right hemisphered oral... panache in his speech. It was just pure stiff anger, or maybe cool panic. And I just was struck by nothing communicated other than his anger. So he didn't have a very comprehensive view of the situation his ilk are in right now.
Mm-hmm.
He was reacting, not acting. He was reacting, not acting.
Certainly, Citizen LaRouche has written a lot about Black, and what was seen tonight on Channel 10 really underscores a lot of what he's been saying.
Yeah, but this is full of elephant traps. Let's move into something
lighter.
Let's
move into one other subject,
okay.
And that is that I want to rejoice this evening. I am very, very rejoicing. I hope people don't take this in the wrong.
Are you going to bring up the friggin' metaphor? The friggin' metaphor?
Let me just finish.
Mr. Fry?
Talking about Mr. Elephant Traps.
Yeah, Mr. Fry.
I just want to say that without being in a detrimental way, I'm rejoicing this evening at the passing of Northrop Fry, Mr. Northrop from Northrop Corporation, one of the big arms dealers who fry a lot of people with their bombs.
Yeah.
And Northrop Fry left the scene last night.
On the 22nd.
On the 22nd.
Yeah, or the 20th.
And this is a huge, huge depth charge in the hidden ground.
Well, I'm pretty...
And something that everybody should note, because this man has been the antithesis of everything which we have been trying to unearth. This man is one of the great wordsmiths. Definitely a useful fool, absolutely hoiked up and given tremendous acclaim for writings which aren't worth the paper they're written on.
Well, Tom, I think of what they quoted on the news tonight, Marsha McLuhan, saying that every critic was looking for a place in the sun, but Northrop didn't have to look for a place in the sun because he was the sun.
Yep.
All right. Now, the point is here, that's a hidden metaphor by Marshall, and we all know about the famous battle between Marshall McLuhan and Northrop Frye in Canadian literary circles. The point is that
it's like the battle between Dobbs and Touche.
That's true, but here, to put it in a more general known area, is you use Finnegan's Wake, which Marshall was always using. The battle in Finnegan's Wake, the battle of the twin brothers, was between Shem and Sean.
Yep.
Now, Sean was the day boy, the bright, wonderful achiever of visual space.
Yep.
He was the sun god.
Yep.
All right? Now, Marshall was the underground. He was the Shem, the real artist. And so when he said Northrop Frye was the sun,
mm-hmm.
he was saying he's that creepy character Sean in Finnegan's Wake.
That's very, very brilliant observation and perception, Bob. Once again, you've shown you've been honing your fireproof perceptual apparatus for doing sensory threshold analyses at the speed of thought. Just tremendous. Why, you are the greatest artist alive today, and that includes everyone else, Bob.
Well, do you like this? That's right. Do you like this phrase, motivated some mobilization? Some mobilization. That's mixed corporate media. That's what we're seeing, right? Not somnambulist, but some mobilization.
Mm-hmm.
Motivated some mobilization. But how about this pattern?
Yeah.
The first attack plane took off at 2:32 a.m., and its number was 1696.
Mm-hmm.
That's
22.
Adds up to 22. 1, 6, 7, 9, 16, 6, 22.
Forms a number of 22s.
Yeah, and then Operation Storm, if you add up the letters S-T-O-R-M, it adds up to 22, as
mm-hmm.
a subgenius pointed out to me. So again, these hidden iconic tactile form around numerology services a game.
Storm also being Strom.
Yes, and Tom, I'd like to commend you on the phrase, hurt the Irish into poetry and song. I would say that television hurt everybody, but especially the TV kids, and it hurt them into a right hemisphere preference for poetry and song. All right?
Okay.
That's really important when you think of the Beatles. I mean, it came just after the Kennedy assassination, a couple of months, and a whole American generation, a North American generation, was hurt by the Kennedy assassination, and they were hurt into a neurotic need for poetry and song.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I want you to respond on next show. You work on that one.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, Mike,
were
you hurt into poetry and song?
Not as a child.
Okay.
No.
When you went to university, you were, right?
When I dropped out.
Yeah.
Not to be overlooked in all this, of course, was, and I haven't even talked to you about this over the phone, but the last episode of Twin Peaks, I think, brought it all home, didn't it? I was disappointed after the break, with the show after the break.
When was that?
We've had two shows since the three-week break.
Well, Tim pointed out the one before the break, the one after the break was good with the ending of the storm clouds. The timing was appropriate, right? You like that, but
mm-hmm.
you were generally disappointed with that show.
That show, yeah.
But this show.
But last week.
Doesn't that point the arrow at us? I mean, the whole Exodus theme is coming in. It's obvious now,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should play this. We got some callers?
That's why I mentioned that. We do have Dublin on the line, but this is a short
clip. Yeah, Dublin can hold. I'm glad you brought up the Twin Peaks because this clip is something that Bob Marshall gave me. He taped it off of... No, that would be side two, Mike, just in case. Side two at the end of that tape. What it is Bob Marshall was watching TV Ontario in the summer of 81. It should be side two, as if you're going to the end. Oh, no, not... That's later. That's the... You want to do that one first? No, do that later. That's the one with my predictions. Yeah,
is that what you want?
No, that's. Let's just play that for a second. Just to remind people, it's the one in your hand. We're going to play that side one, and then we're going to go to what I was going to talk about. Just so that, yeah, side one. This is just to prove everybody that my CBC address made predictions, and one for one, I just want to play this prediction, this part of the Address to the Nation I made on January 1st, which was taped on December 3rd, 1990. This proves that I was right about the war starting in the third week, and the third week is from the 14th to the 21st, 15th to the 21st.
It just played. Oh, you got side one on. Where's the sound?
Meanwhile, my fellow sub-geniuses will be basking in the slack, ignoring the headlines, fully prepared as that which must come to pass comes to pass. Having purchased a good sweater in anticipation of our freezing cold winter, the sub-genius will be ready as the shooting begins in the Persian Gulf during the third week of January 1991. And over 10 million East Europeans and Russians flood into Western Europe.
All right, there's proof that so far I'm one for one. The 10 million Americans, or 10 million Americans flooding into Europe, or Russians, whatever they are. These are mythical archetypes. We'll have to see if that happens. Now, this next thing, in relation to the Twin Peaks, what's amazing is that David Lynch is showing us the high-tech or the high multi-leveled post-nature exploration that the defense establishments are doing, and Major Briggs is very involved in this. He has done some kind of time travel or astral projection or was forced into it, and we're going to find out what the something is in the White Lodge. He says, didn't they say it was underground? They're focusing on something in the earth, and I hope they don't get into the corny hollow earth syndrome. But the thing about this is Bob Marshall taped this in the summer, late August, 1981 on TV Ontario when everybody was up in cottage country, nobody was watching, and they had this short series called Best Kept Secrets, and they played this thing, and it's amazing how accurate it is to the technology I know I've been able to use for years. But Bob Marshall saw this, and we've played this a few years ago, but keep this, as you listen to this, the seven or eight forms of technology they elucidate that they know governments have around the world in 1981. Think of how Lynch is approximating that with showing the phenomenal military operation that Briggs is involved in right now, the White Lodge, right? So let's go ahead with that.
Over half the U.S. and British spy systems are trying to get hold of those technological secrets both inside and outside the Soviet Union. On this map, the Russian city of Fergana is forbidden to all foreigners. Bacteriological science and physics, some of which we cannot yet understand, make it a haven for spies. Here is made antimatter. A gram of it would wipe out London in a few seconds. Actually, it is antimercury, and on contact with real mercury produces an explosion without end. Here, too, Bruno Pontecorvo, Turnford spy, has developed a telescope that can see through the Earth to the other side. At this Chinese town, scientists have perfected a machine to collect large amounts of lightning over towns. This electrical charge lowers the brain of man to that of an animal. Already tests have proved successful with prisoners. In California, a U.S. scientist has developed californium. Shot from an ordinary rifle, it has the power of an H-bomb. This is Dubway, Utah, where U.S. scientists have a defoliant, a small amount of which is enough to kill the population of the Earth. This in itself is enough to justify high-level espionage today. Here at Baikonur, Russia, a man, Kozarev, has harnessed time as a source of military energy, and another, K. Vasilich, has developed a beam which can control the brain of a man walking down the street on the other side of the road. Now these are known facts, not science fiction. They are few among many. But what of other horrors yet unknown to us? Almost the only way to stop this ride into technological suicide is to make sure that we are not left behind. And that's where spies come in. U.S. and British spies work actively out of Fergana and Baikonur and a dozen other secret towns, passing information through Tashkent and Kabul. They are all technical men. Of course, most spy networks are not in the remote corners of Russia and China. Between them, the KGB and the CIA have an estimated 300,000 agents. They are mostly in traditional centers such as London, Beirut, Paris, Vienna, and Moscow.
Okay, Mike, that second last statement, this is 1981, time as a military weapon. Now, what the heck does that mean if you're not on the Secret Council of Ten, if you're just an average citizen here in Toronto hearing this? I think that that's maybe what Lynch is working towards. I don't know if it involves time, but if you're working in the fourth dimension, then you're able to leave this dimension, and that's what Briggs is doing. So I thought that this Twin Peaks is getting way beyond our wildest
preferences and hopes. It's just walking right down, just walking up to my doorway. Don't you think, Mike? And that's what you saw. You don't fully understand all that went on in the last show, but you know it led to us, right? You know, just the I love the opening scene where he's sitting in a jungle or something in a fire, right?
The fantasy.
Yeah. And now, was he supposed to be hypnotized and coming out of hypnosis, or did they hypnotize him?
I don't think so, no. I think maybe he was just so overwhelmed by his experience that he was, in the process of being interviewed, he was just
thinking of it.
Traveling.
Yeah, like in the old days, in the 50s, they show a little blurry technique to show you that the person was dreaming it. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, you don't show that blurring anymore, which I think is a result of television. But the, because fiction and nonfiction are blurred, right?
We should get to Dublin, if he's still there.
Okay, just the final thought on that is that, you know, when he was showing the fire and then this sort of followed shelter sign, whirled out of the fire? I don't know if you noticed, it's a symbol on the neck. The bite in the neck, and I think that's a common thing in UFO tradition, that people who get abducted have this mark on their neck. It might have been in the movie Communion, but it's interesting how Lynch is playing off the interest.
Hey,
Dublin.
I'm not Dublin.
Oh, this guy.
Yeah, it's Howard.
Howard, right. Howard always has some fine corrections to make.
I wanted to talk about the war.
Okay.
And the electronic war. You haven't said whether it's being fought from 22,000 miles or so out in space.
Yeah, that's what we mean by satellite coverage, a solar government war. That's what the phrase refers to. It is 22,000 miles above. That's where the observational points of Dobstown are. That's
and
where I'm working.
And the U.S. military, too.
Yeah, that's where I'm working from. Now, that's a given, but you're right to point it out every now and then that we are operating at that point.
And as far as I've heard, I haven't heard if the Iraqis are still up there, which I imagine they were down quite a while ago.
Yeah, they were. They did put something
up. I haven't heard that at all on the media. The media used to say the odd thing about the Iraqis having a satellite, but they didn't say anything about it going down.
That's right. That's a fine point. Dublin would appreciate that because he pointed that out about last year when that happened. That, as a matter of fact, maybe that we knew that was serious. When they sent that up, they were moving to solar government territory, so I guess that's why he had to be duped into a war, right? So that, you're pointing the hidden ground. The hidden ground is a satellite. That's the cause of this war. And they
didn't say anything about it going down, but one thing I noticed is that Wednesday morning, when I woke up, the war was on. Bush was attacking electronically. They said on the news that he was jamming. And I said, Bush attack.
Bush attack, is that a pun?
Well, Bush is attacking the Iraqis right now. People were waiting to see if the war was going to start. But Wednesday morning, he was attacking already, electronically. That was an invasion. He was.
Oh, I see, before.
He was jamming the Iraqis, even before the primetime war.
So when you heard that, you knew there would be a war within a few hours?
Well, I didn't know, and I didn't know whether it would escalate or de-escalate,
yeah.
But I knew that Bush was attacking Iraq. It wasn't really being reported that way. They were saying he's jamming. Well, that's electronic attack against electronic weapons.
Yeah, what? Now, maybe they didn't knock, they're not going to knock out the satellite because the Iraqi families that the agreement has been made to bring them in once they destroy the Ba'athist Party, part of the agreement is that they be part of the solar government and have their satellite maintained.
But wouldn't they be using the satellite to fight the U.S. and
not if they
knock down U.S. planes?
Well, maybe they have some jamming abilities to so that Hussein can't use it.
Oh, I used to read in the news, I used to be... Subgenius before I knew what it was.
Yeah.
Sometimes I used to look through the newspapers when I used to still read. And I used to look for the smallest articles possible.
Yeah.
And I also noticed things that they don't repeat over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
And I used to read about how Russian satellites were knocking down American satellites.
Yeah, that's Dr. Beter's area.
And the Americans got one or two of the Russian satellites, and I read three or four of these little one-inch, two-inch articles. I think they were from World Watch.
Yeah.
And the score was heavily in favor of the Russians. It ended up something like 5-2 or something, and then I never read about it or heard about it again
now,
for a couple years. And then Reagan came out with his Star Wars.
Right. So you're talking in the late 70s, early 80s?
A couple of years before Reagan announced Star Wars.
In 83, he announced it. So you're talking about exactly what one of our holy offices, Dr. Beter, features. He talked about these battles all the time, and he maintained that Russia, by 77, early 78, dominated the solar government position.
It was something like 5-2 or something.
Yeah, and so you actually saw, you know, trickle-down evidence of that. But
so Star Wars isn't something that the Americans cannot do yet. They can shoot down that satellite.
That's right.
They had that ability.
So probably they aren't going to. They're going to give it to the controlled Iraqi families who will inherit the mess in Iraq once they get rid of the Ba'athist Party.
Unless it's gone.
But that, what?
Unless it's gone.
Yeah. But,
it might be.
It might
not be there.
That's a good point. But
I was hoping you would have heard something.
Well, I'm involved, but I feel like a Pentagon spokesman. I can't reveal that level of involvement because I'm very involved. As a matter of fact, there are people who want my services for entertainment possibilities around Toronto, and I'm just not available. And my colleague Bob Marshall's gone underground. So I'm very involved in this situation. It's hard to believe, you know, that I'm doing this, but that's how absurd the world is.
It's an interesting game that I'll watch. I'm watching.
Well, have you ever heard Dr. Beter's tapes? Guess not.
Yes, about organic robotoids and about the Golden Fort.
Remember the satellite, the Cosmos 949 or whatever that came out of over Canada in early 78? The radioactive parts that fell in the
one
Canadian...
that fell, yeah.
Yeah, that was an effect of the Battle of the Harvest Moon, which happened on September 27, 1977. You see, the Americans shut down the space program in 1972-73 so they could start to build this Star Wars scenario in the middle 70s. And the Russians were doing their part. Actually, they were Bolshevik-controlled Russia at that point. And they had the battle in 77. And the shooting down of satellites is the fallout from that you were tracking in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
And many people don't believe Beter, but just having a call like yours.
Used to be in the Toronto Star.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Tom Rich has experience in, he was hunting for that Russian debris in 78. Maybe he'll call us and tell us about his experience looking for that. He was part of the search party for that debris in 78.
Their space station is supposed to be coming down.
The
Russian space station.
It's falling, you mean? Like
falling or recently fallen. I heard it on the news a few weeks ago.
Like Skylab.
Yeah, but it's the one that they called their station.
Yeah. Well, the Skylab was shot out in the Battle of Harvest Moon, so they had to fake the Chicken Little syndrome in 79, in summer of 79.
I guess it's the thing that they hold the guys up in for months at a time.
Yeah, so once you know this kind of solar government structure, then you know that the war we're witnessing is nowhere near where the battle is really going on, and we don't know who is involved, really, in this fight. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know who's really involved.
Yeah, and we don't know who's firing the Scud missiles.
I don't think Israel was handling it, though.
And so this could make people paranoid because we may not be really living in Toronto. We don't know what the position of this real estate area right here in Toronto that we can't visualize under electric discarnate conditions, but it's there when we get off the radio. We walk around with our bodies. We don't know where that position is in relation to the missiles, really.
We don't know who really owns us, therefore what side we're on.
Yeah, so therefore, that's a good point. We don't know who owns us and what side we're on. So that's why you've got to listen to the Exodus broadcast we do in 2 weeks where we tell you what happens when you die.
I don't know whether the Queen of England has been investing in Canada or whether the Japanese or whether the Kuwaitis, who I understand make more money out of their Western investments than they make, has been making, selling oil.
That's true.
Which
yeah.
means they're on the side of Western survival now.
Yeah.
In order to make money.
Yeah. That should tell you something. That should tell you something. And the other thing is...
At one point, they switched over when they started making more cash from one than the other.
Yeah. That's right. Do you know that the electric environment can't be bought, sold, or stolen? So we can share this freedom, this information overload of wealth at all levels in the electric age, and it doesn't relate to the money purchase level, the property level. You know what I mean?
As long as I pay my phone bill, or I go to a phone at the corner, I can call you.
Or you can go to your friends.
Yeah.
So this is very hard for the Conrad Blacks, the bankers of the world, to relate their visual money world to the free world of electric ownership, which we all own. We all participate and create content for it. So that's the crisis of identity.
Well, I'm just dizzy because I don't know what Conrad Black owns anymore or who
that's
owns
right.
Canada anymore. I used to hear on the news, and I used to hear that the Rockefellers used to own a lot of Canada.
Yeah.
And that a lot of the debt, and if you look at people's mortgages, you can say so much of all this money owed is American Rockefeller money, but not anymore.
That's why we say it's a rule for subgeniuses not to speak English unless artistically or to use anthropomorphic images because they don't exist anymore.
Well, that was ancient history.
Yeah.
When I was a kid.
The idea that language was obsolete is ancient history.
I'm talking language because that was ancient.
Yeah,
no,
language.
I don't know.
Yeah, the thing is that you're helping people understand the dizzying, dislocalized situation we're in. So there's no reason to listen to anybody who's trying to tell you something because it's impossible to tell anything.
I never believed anything.
All right, so what is the snow? What is this, we'll call it snow, this storm of content that's swirled around the environment that people make billions of dollars off if they're involved in it, either as actors or advertising, and yet there's no money actually under electric conditions needed to share the electric environment. So we're looking at a lot of snow. Operation Storm has been World War III, right?
Yeah, it's a real snowstorm in the desert.
Well, it's a wasteland. The city
can't
see
what in the desert anymore because of the storm.
Well, like it was in the wasteland, which was Eliot's image of the city, was suffering the storm of information overkill. And now the hardware boys have hijacked the software storm to the desert. What is in the desert that is such an archetypal setting? What is it about the desert?
It reminds me a lot of like Libya, the actions against Libya, only bigger and longer.
Yeah. Is the desert, does that resonate with The Dune, the book The Dune, which Lynch made into a movie? Was that a desert? Was there much deserts in that movie?
Yes.
There was, Mike? Yeah, so the desert is a super powerful image.
The image that I get, being a somewhat organic person, not as in the organic religion, but I notice what's growing and alive around. But when I see the desert, I see there's very little sustainable life. And what do these people live off of? And what are they doing there? The desert is a wasteland where people hardly belong at all.
Yeah, it's the opposite of human scale.
There's no food, there's no animals. It's wasteland.
It really is the only visual image you can approximate the apocalypse of populations being discarnate. I mean, they don't have a body anymore. So that's why the desert would be the last setting for an apocalyptic scenario, right?
It would be an accursed place.
Yeah. Which is what we created here with the electric environment overkill. So you would join our cause to be monomaniacal about media ecology, wouldn't you?
I think I've been a media ecologist before I heard you, Bob.
Okay.
I just realized I was a subgenius when I heard you.
That's what we are, subgenius.
That's right.
What is it, the sub-Sahara?
Is that where they are?
No, there's a phrase, the region where the desert is creeping on the North African countries.
Oh, yeah,
they call it the sub-region.
The Sahara gets bigger.
Yeah, so the sub-genius has a desert echo there. Are we fighting the desert or helping spread it by making people aware of how deserted we are? I think that's the pun, deserted. Okay, caller, thanks a lot.
Thank you, bye
now. Okay.
I think we should move things along. It's already almost 10 to 2 o'clock.
So that gives Dublin 5 minutes?
How much time do we need for the theme tonight?
No, 5 minutes.
So 5 minutes to wrap up the subgenius show. So, well, there's 7 minutes or so.
Okay, so is Dublin next?
Might be. Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, that phone just rang.
Yeah. Okay, Deb.
Oh, not too much. You got my brain going in circles there.
Why? That's interesting. How did your brain go in circles?
Well, because the beginning of the show, if the print, not print technology, but it was writing, really, because it came before print.
Yeah.
But when you talk about the consolidation of the vernacular is the language of each country as opposed to Latin, for example.
No, that was a quote from Innes.
That's right.
And the point about Innes is he was a little confused since he was the first to break into this new territory of media analysis.
Well, no, right. But
so it's confused. That is a confusing quote. I can see.
No, it's not. Not to me. See, the consolidation of vernaculars just means that in Spanish they started pumping up Spanish, and in England they started pumping up English, and
yeah.
In France they started pumping up French, and they forgot about Latin and Greek.
But the first words are the application of power to the communication industries.
No. As each country consolidated its vernacular and made it the official language of the court, the law, and literature, and made it a language capable of doing science and going into the future with,
yeah.
Then you had the emergence of the nation states. That was the point made at the beginning of the program, that the consolidation of the vernaculars was simultaneous with the emergence of the nation state.
All right, now how does that create a dizzying effect?
Well, because, you see, under electric conditions, it's evident to me that we're going to have a consolidation of electric vernaculars, so to speak.
And what would they be?
Now, that's an open question, Bob, because, you see, under electric conditions in the discorporate electric environment, who's to say what they will be? But they will be a consolidation in each area, each population, each interest group of their own concerns, how they creatively come to terms with electric conditions.
I think it would be multi-leveled. You're giving me insights as you bring this question up. Print reduced to a single-level organization of the body politic. The multi-level will be the world government, the regional, and the tribalism, the fourth world.
No, because later on you talked about time as a military weapon, and how does that happen?
Yeah.
Now, Innes in that same book said that, Babylonians, by building their pyramids in space, in effect, they control time.
Yeah.
It's a hard concept, but you can see what he means. Everybody, in order to read the word, or to hear the official word of the gods, or to do
it
your
was
business.
Hearing. Remember, the priests kept the manuscripts to themselves, or the clay tablets. That was the reason they controlled time. It was when you brought in the alphabet, cabinets of men sprang up military teeth. All right.
Well,
and that broke up the time control.
Yeah, but see, Innes is concerned with that kind of an analysis.
Yeah.
If you build in space, you control time. If you build in time, you control space. Now, if you think about this, it doesn't get easier to understand the more you think about it. It gets harder to understand, right?
That's right. You get to percept. You move out of concept to direct percept.
Well, my way of saying it is that it gets harder to understand.
That means conceptualize, harder to translate back into concept.
Yeah, but if you try to make an algebra out of it, it's going to get difficult for you because...
Okay, now that's what the tetrad is. The tetrad is an attempt to consolidate the electric vernaculars.
Yeah, but what's happening in the Gulf right now is not necessarily the tetrad.
Well, certainly Gorby's doing it. Just to comment on Gorby, he is flipping his image because the human scale thing has flipped into a new need in the Russian Revolution that's going on there, and he had to change. Now, people are upset. They're saying this is not the same Gorby. It is the same Gorby. He knows how to test
it. What he's missing, everybody's help. That's the point. That's the point I'm trying to make here. Like you said on your New Year's broadcast that there'd be 10 million refugees and so on and so forth. Nobody's looking at that. Now, what's the message that's going on in the Gulf right now? The reason I'm trying to bring this out is this. I believe that the biblical interpretation of what's going on in the Gulf is 100% wrong. And I also believe that it's not an update on Libya. And I don't believe most of what the media is saying. Like, the real message that's going on right there, right now, is that everybody in the world needs Patriot missiles. I don't know why anybody can't see that. If the Iraqis had spent their money on Patriot missiles, for example, they'd be proof against the American war right now. Secondly, they don't need Scuds to drop gas on Israel. All they have to do is put it on a boat and park it in Haifa Harbor or Tel Aviv Harbor and blow the sucker up. Everybody knows that. It's just intelligence in action. That's all software is. That's all hardware is. Now, you got a cruise missile, which can go in the front door of any building that you specify in the city. They did that to the military command headquarters is in Baghdad, the night that you talked about on TV there, right? Now, that night on TV, you had Reagan's Star Wars arrived in Baghdad, and they gave us a one-second flash of it, right?
Yeah.
But there's so many details that we've all been completely distracted from. And the idea, I don't like to disagree with ideas. I'd rather think about them and make them grow into something, right? But I want to disagree with this idea right now to make a point. The idea that CNN has got control of the corporate media right now is not right. If all the players on the world stage act with enough creativity and imagination, then we'll compel them to broadcast the news that's happening by simply overloading the suckers. They won't be able to pick and choose the news and show us what they want to show us and behavioral engineer our future in that way. We just have to overload them. We have to get back to China and say, what next after Tiananmen Square? Get back to Japan and say, sell Patriot missiles. That's the reason that Gorbachev broke down the wall, was because he realized that without Japanese microprocessing, he wasn't going to have a future Star Wars military technology, and that he couldn't make it in his own economy without loosening his own economy up and cooperating with the Japanese and cooperating with everybody else. The Chinese are not ignorant. They know this. They see it. They see it very, very clearly. The outburst of popular sentiment in China is going to be echoed in Europe. The Russian parliament right now is standing up and condemning Gorbachev, the very man that they just elected, for not controlling the military violence on the Baltic. Well, I think the only thing that's happening in Russia right now is that the Red Army faction at the core of their power structure wants to keep that tremendous military access to the sea open until they're dead sure what's happening. And that's the only thing that's happening in Latvia. I hate to say it, but it's almost like the Baltic states are being a little bit greedy. Now, I could be very wrong about that. If I am, I apologize, okay?
Okay, we got to end there, Dub.
Okay, so...
Thanks a lot.
Oh, yeah, okay, good enough. Oh, let me throw in one last thing.
Okay.
That, there should be more to this, but if that, I think that was 10-6-0-8-7 on that first airplane, wasn't it?
It wasn't what? It's 1696.
I had it as 10-6-0-8-7.
Okay,
well, that, to me, that indicates that 0-8-7 are the numbers to bet on the lottery, and I think, checking my charts, that's important. And the one more thing is this, Northrop Frye, right?
Yeah.
He said that, I think he was quite brilliant. Didn't he do Anatomy of Criticism?
Yes.
So we should praise him now that he's died. The thing is, he deserves it. He says that it's futile to analyze a character in a play. He says a character in a play does not have the job of representing a human being or the structures of psychology or any other artifact. A character in a play has the job of being a character in a play, which is not the same thing as a human being. The technology, software technology of plays goes way back before the Greeks, right? So the job of a character in a play, according to Northrop Frye, was to represent directly. The character in a play is discorporate without ever having been human and is magically real. And his job is to represent directly mythic character, archetypal reality.
That's why
Twin Peaks is screwed too, because the Gulf War has just squeezed it and squeezed it, and those people are just like they're like walking through molasses, and they will be until this thing clears up.
Okay, thanks a lot. That gives us fair coverage on the Northern.
The way we're going to do it is to recognize the humanity of the Iraqis and not kill them.
Well, I just hope Kent doesn't cut us off. We've got a nice theme song.
Well, it can't end up in blood, and that's the most important lesson we're going to know for Iraq. No matter what anybody says right now, Bush is going to win, and it's not going to end up in a bloodbath, because the Iraqi common people have got a right to their own electric reality. And that's what the consolidation of the new electric conditional vernaculars is leading to. They are learning their own McLuhan grammar, and they're going to go someplace we don't know, and they're going to do it in Baghdad.
Thanks a lot, Doug.
Okay.
Point taken. All right, Mike, we got to go, right?
That's it, yeah.
Okay, I hope Kent will tolerate this. This is, again, another intense Tai Chi Church hymn to dance to as we sail into a show in 2 weeks. But tonight, stay tuned for the May Brussel Sherman Skolik thing with... But there's no Skolnick tonight, so maybe we could tolerate it. Anyways, you like Frank. It's not Daddy Cool. You like Frank. So Ken's going to let us play the theme song. Thanks for engineering a wonderful show, Mike. You did it again. I hope you're back in 2 weeks, Mike.
I hope so, too.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Okay, Bob. Praise Bob.